Welcome to the 257th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are an overview of Patrick's weekend predictions, an overview of the NBA playoffs, and our weekly look at Major League Baseball action. Let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com. And we will start in the NBA, where Patrick went 2-2 with his predictions. In Major League Baseball, Patrick went 3-1 with his Major League Baseball weekend series predictions. That means Patrick went 5-3 this week, and it brings him to a 1,045 and 676 overall record. That's a 60.7% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, that winning percentage hasn't moved in a little bit. It's pretty hard with how big the sample size is for that to happen. But yeah, these were predictions for the first game of the NBA playoff series and all of them. The Cavs beat the Magic 97-83. We're going to talk about all these in depth later, so I won't go into that much depth immediately. But I predicted that one right. And then the Timberwolves beat the Suns 120-95, which I got correct. Both of those series starting on Saturday. So I got the two Saturday games wrong. But then on Sunday, the two games that were impacted by injuries, I overestimated how much they would be impacted. Obviously, the Clippers, playing without Kawhi Leonard, still beat the Mavericks 109-97. I have a lot of thoughts about that game that we'll get to later. And then the Bucks beat the Pacers 109-94. That I have a lot of similar thoughts about that game, too, without Giannis in that game for the Bucks. But overall, I think I picked fine in the NBA, and I'll talk about why I'm not too upset with those picks later, but it'll boil down to the team I picked played bad, less so than the team they were playing played well. But I'll go into more depth about that later. But from a prediction standpoint, that's what I felt. So, I mean, that's, I don't feel too bad about getting those wrong. And then MLB, like you said, I went 3-1. So the Blue Jays took 2 of 3 from the Padres, which I won. The Yankees took 2 of 3 from the Rays, which I won. The Braves took 2 of 3 from the Rangers. I won that one. And the Orioles took 2 of 3 from the Royals. That was the only one I got wrong. I was really on the fence about the Orioles-Royals series in the first place, not only because it's a tongue twister, but also just because I think pitching-wise, it was a pretty even series. I think each team had their ace on the mound in one of the games. Corbin Burns for the Orioles and Cole Reagans for the Royals. So, and they had them on the mound in different games. So each of them, I thought, were going to win those games with their respective aces on the mound. And, you know, then it comes down to who wins the third game. And that's just which offense do you trust more? The Orioles offense is better, but the Royals offense had been hitting better recently. So I stuck with them. And then, of course, in the Sunday night game to clinch the series, they didn't score. The Braves already had the first two from the Rangers before that series, had their Sunday game. The Yankees took their series clincher on Sunday. And then the Blue Jays also, like the Braves, took the first two and had won the series by Sunday, and the Padres and the Rangers were just avoiding sweeps in those games. But satisfied with those predictions, I think I have a better strategy of picking this year. I haven't been that great at picking in the past, but I think I've developed a newer strategy to get more of those games correct, which is basically just actually put a lot more stock into pitching matchups than I have in the past. I definitely always look at the probables, but then sometimes I just say, well, doesn't matter who's pitching, this X is better than Y. And I kind of ignore the matchups, but I think they are more important on a game-to-game basis, especially this year with all the injuries going around. I think that, you know, having a solid starting pitcher on the mound actually does make probably a bigger impact this year than it has in prior years, because the offenses are all healthy, but the pitching staffs are not. So we'll see how that strategy change pays off. So far, it's doing pretty well to start the season, and I'm satisfied with my predictions overall.
All right. Well, we can see how well that strategy pays off next weekend after looking at Patrick's picks for next weekend. That will be posted on our website, as always, on Thursday. Let's now turn our attention to the NBA with playoff action getting in full swing. We will start in the Western Conference playoff, where number one seeded Oklahoma City is facing number eight seeded New Orleans Pelicans.
OKC leads that series 1-0. They won game one, 94-92. Very, 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 very ugly game. That was, I don't really know how else to describe it. You know, the Pelicans had their fair share of opportunities at the end of the game to win that one. They just didn't take advantage. And really, if you look at this game, it boiled down to the Pelicans just having no offensive, I mean, no offensive game really at all. I'd try to say no one in individually showed up. I think the only guy you could give some credit to is Trey Murphy, who was 8 of 18, had 21 points in 44 minutes on 5 of 12 shooting. And then you could give a lot of credit to Jonas Valanciunas for pitching in with 20 rebounds, including 9 offensive rebounds, and 13 points to go with that on 5 of 9 shooting. But Brandon Ingram was 5 of 17. Herb Jones was 2 of 10. CJ McCollum was 9 of 22, which included 2 of 9 from three. As a team, they shot 28% from three. And you know, you can say, okay, so maybe this will be a close series because they kept this game close without all that, without really having any offensive production. But on the other side of things, the Thunder only shot 43% from the field and 31% from three. You know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was 0 for 3 from 3. Chet Holmgren was 2 for 6 from 3. Jalen Williams was 1 for 5. The other Jalen Williams was 2 for 4. He had some nice contributions. But Josh Giddey was 1 for 6 from the floor in total. Lu Dort was 2 for 6. There were just a lot of bad performances offensively, really, on both sides of this game. So I think the only guy you give some credit to is Jalen Williams for kind of getting it going in the third quarter, helping the Thunder jump out to the lead that they got after halftime. He ended up with 19, 7, and 4. Pretty nice game for him. Just couldn't get it going from the 3-point line. But and then Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had 28, 6, and 4 on 11 of 24 shooting. But you know, even he struggled a little bit, missing a few threes. He had a few turnovers in a row that kept the Pelicans in the game. But I think overall, that's all the Thunder need to fix. They just need to limit the turnovers. The 13 turnovers is just too many. A lot of them came in clutch situations. And then they really just need to get rebounds. I mean, Denver. New Orleans had 18 offensive rebounds in this game. So that is something that they definitely need to fix. It's basically just Valanciunas and Larry Nance had 4 offensive rebounds. Valanciunas had 9. So it's really just those two guys, but they do have to get a better strategy of keeping those guys off the boards. You know, making sure they put a body on them before they even get into the paint. That's what you have to do. Obviously, there's some talk there about the fact that, you know, Chet Holmgren doesn't exactly have the strongest frame, and that's definitely a part of it, but the rebounding is still a team thing. So I think the Thunder can fix that problem. I think they will fix that problem, and I think they didn't play their best game either. Neither of these teams, frankly, played their best, but the Pelicans kept it close because they had so many extra opportunities. If the Thunder can either get some extra opportunities of their own or just stop the Pelicans from getting so many of them, they'll be able to win the next few games in the series pretty comfortably. But I still think it's going to be closer than most 1-8 matchups tend to be.
Okay, let's move over to the number 2-7 series, which features the number 2-seeded and reigning NBA champion Denver Nuggets against the LA Lakers. And Nuggets are now up in that series 2 games to none, the only series in the Western Conference that's played 2 games.
Yeah, the Nuggets are doing exactly what you'd expect them to do in the series. The Lakers did play better in game two, but I'll get to that in a second. Game one, AD had 32 points, 14 rebounds, 5 assists. LeBron had 27 points, 6 rebounds, 8 assists. Those are pretty good performances from the Lakers. That's pretty much what you're going to expect from those two night in and night out. And you really can't ask them for more. AD was 12 of 23 from the floor. That's really efficient. LeBron was 10 of 16 from the floor. That's extremely efficient. 3 of 5 from three. The problem was the other guys on the team. I mean, Torian Prince had 11 off the bench, but he was the only player who scored off the bench. Gabe Vincent, Jackson Hayes, Spencer Dinwiddie didn't even attempt shots at all. None of them, despite playing a combined 25 minutes. And then you have D'Angelo Russell, who was 6 for 20 in that game, 1 for 9 from three. And Austin Reeves had 13, 4, and 3, but you know, 5 of 9 shooting, 2 of 6 from 3. At least he didn't take 20 shots to get there like D'Angelo Russell did. But one of those two, if not both, are going to have a bigger impact on this series if the Lakers are going to win. Because Denver just has such balanced scoring. I mean, we saw this last year in the finals. It seems like every single game you check the box score after, and all of their starters are in double figures, and they get decent production off the bench too. Peyton Watson had 8 off the bench. DeAndre Jordan had 4 points off the bench. Reggie Jackson had 3. He didn't have his best game, but he still had 3 points. Christian Brown had 2. So everybody that played scored except for Justin Holiday. But overall, the Nuggets did get better production from their bench because they got it from multiple places and they just chipped in when they needed to. And then in their starting lineup, every single player was in double figures. Aaron Gordon had 12 points, 11 rebounds, 7 assists, so nearly a triple-double for him. Michael Porter Jr. did his thing, was 3 of 7 from 3, 19 points, 8 rebounds. Nikola Jokic, 32, 12, and 7, doing his thing. Jamal Murray, 22, 10, and 6. And then KCP, who had 12 points on 4 of 10 from shooting from the three-point line. So, this was exactly what you'd expect Denver to do. They won 114 to 103 as a result. I mean, I think this is normally what you see in this series between the two. But at the same time, the Lakers did just let them have some shoot around in the middle of the game multiple times. There was some horrible defense being played. And I leave on that point because in the second game, the Lakers actually did do a better job playing pick and roll defense. I will give them credit for doing that. Really, the only reason Denver was able to win this game, and they won 101-99, was off a buzzer beater by Jamal Murray. And I don't think they win this game if Jamal Murray didn't really pick up his game at the very end. If you look at the shooting numbers, overall across the board, Denver was worse in game one than they were in game two. KCP didn't hit any threes. Aaron Gordon had 14, 7, and 3, so more points, but less in all the other categories. Michael Porter Jr., though, he hit 6 threes in that game. The Lakers just could not stop him. They kept leaving the wrong guy open. I will say that was probably the biggest gripe I would have. The Nuggets bench did not hit a three. Christian Brown did have 10 points, but all that in the paint. Peyton Watson had 2 points. But overall, the bench went 0 for 9 from three. Actually, overall, outside of Michael Porter Jr. and Nikola Jokic, nobody on the Nuggets made a single three-pointer in this game. Michael Porter Jr. was 6 of 10, and the rest of the team was 2 of 24. So the Lakers did do a good job of limiting a lot of players on the Nuggets. But in the end, Jokic had 27, 20, and 10. He had a double-double at the end of the first quarter. It just was one of those games where the Lakers really did control it defensively for a while, but they let it slip at the end, and Jamal Murray started to heat up, and they just couldn't stop him from getting into the paint. And that's when their pick and roll defense kind of started to fall apart because the Nuggets players realized that the Lakers were doing a better job of rotating to their guys and getting out to 3-point shooters. And they just said, okay, fine. We're putting the ball in the hands of our best two players. Jokic and Murray are running pick and rolls at the end of this game, no matter what. It's going to be those two in the two-man game. And we're going to see if you can stop it. And the Lakers couldn't. They did have a bunch of players on the Lakers had good games. D'Angelo Russell hit 7 threes. Had five and had was 5 of 5 in the first quarter, I think. He had 23 points. LeBron had 26, 12, and 8. AD had 32, 11, and 2. So 14 of 19 shooting for AD as well. So that's a pretty good number. Everybody on the Lakers played pretty decent, I would say. But, it just came down to once again, they couldn't stop the Nuggets in the most important moments of the game. And they had the lead pretty much the entire game, but the Nuggets came back and stole it right at the end.
Yeah, Lakers blew a golden opportunity to steal a game on the road. We'll see what happens in that series. Let's turn our attention to the other series, starting with number three, Minnesota versus number six, Phoenix, where Minnesota leads one game to none.
Yeah, I said this was going to be the most fun series, or maybe I said it was second most fun. I forgot which one I ended up going with between this one and the Clippers series, which we'll talk about in a second. But so far, man, it's this one. I mean, this game was just amazing. Kevin Durant had 31 points on 11 of 17 shooting, and he was a complete and total afterthought in this game because Anthony Edwards had 33, 9, and 6 on 14 of 24 shooting. And it's really important to note that because Ant had actually struggled in the matchups against Phoenix, And one of the reasons why I do think that this will be a closer series than the regular season series was, where Phoenix took all three games, is because he's just not going to do that again. 14 points a game for him in the regular season against Phoenix, that's just not going to happen. He's going to step up his game, and that's exactly what he did in this first game. And Minnesota really just wrote off that performance and, took it to the bank and won this game. I think also it's worth mentioning that Minnesota's bench is just way better than the Suns' bench. Grayson Allen and Royce O'Neal, I would kind of count as, kind of swing players, where one of them, Grayson Allen, doesn't play as many minutes as you would expect from a starter. And Royce O'Neal is kind of the guy who will come in most of the time in those non-Grayson Allen minutes. Grayson Allen only had 4 points in the first game. Royce O'Neal had 14 off the bench on 4 of 8 from three. But other than that, they got 2 points in garbage time from Josh Okogie. They got 2 points in garbage time from Nasir Little, and that was their bench production. So if Phoenix is going to get that off the bench, aka get nothing off the bench, and Devin Booker is going to go 5 for 16, and Bradley Beal is only going to take 10 shots and score 15 and be 6 of 10, but which is efficient, but didn't really put his imprint on the game at all. If that's how it's going to go, Phoenix isn't going to win the series. They either have to get bench production or their starters have to be on point when we're talking about the big three that they have between Beal, Booker, and Durant. And that just wasn't the case in game one. Meanwhile, Minnesota for bench production, well, first of all, in the starting lineup, Gobert had 14 points, 16 rebounds. Karl-Anthony Towns had 19 points on 5 of 9 shooting. They kind of just let Anthony Edwards take over, obviously. But even Naz Reid had 4 of 10, was 4 of 10 from the floor, had 12 points. And Nickeil Alexander-Walker had 18 points on 7 of 12 shooting, including 4 threes. So that bench production really pushed the Timberwolves over the edge in this game. And I'm liking how they looked in game one in terms of how they might go through the rest of the series.
All right, let's move to the final Western Conference series, where the number four seeded LA Clippers lead the number five seeded Dallas Mavericks 1 game to 9.
Well, this might have been the most surprising result in the first round, considering that Paul George, or excuse me, that Paul George and Co yeah, Paul George and James Harden were leading the show because Kawhi was out. But Avicii Zubac pitched in, scored some extra points when the Clippers needed them. Russell Westbrook was 2 of 4 from three, 13 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists off the bench. So they got enough scoring to replace Kawhi's normal production. Terrence Mann had 13 points on 3 of 3 shooting. Teams have been actually lagging off of Terrence Mann because he hasn't necessarily shot the ball super well this year, a 35% 3-point shooter. So teams, when they're given the option of, doubling James Harden, doubling Paul George, that kind of a thing, they will tend to leave Mann as the open guy. But he was knocking it down in game one. So that strategy might need to change heading into game two. Paul George had 22 points, 8 of 20 shooting, 4 of 12 from three. Not his best game, but not a terrible game either. But James Harden was the one who got everything going in the first half, in the first quarter. I believe he had like 16 points on like 5 of 6 shooting at some point at the beginning of this game. Had 20, ended with 28 and 8. And then on the other end of things, I mean, this is just disappointing performance from Dallas. That's all I can say. They scored 8 points in the second quarter. They scored 30 in the first half total. Luka Doncic had 33, 13, and 6. But 11 of 26 shooting was, good enough to keep them in the game kind of at the end, but they really never had a chance at this one. No one scored in double figures outside of Irving Doncic and PJ Washington, who had 11 points. They just need to get any scoring from anybody on this team that's not named Kyrie Irving or Luka Doncic, and they'll be fine. But the way it looked in game one, I'm just not so sure where that comes from. So we'll just have to see what happens in that series going forward. But a good start for the Clippers.
All right, let's turn our attention now over to the Eastern Conference. We'll start with that 1-8 matchup, which is Boston over Miami, 1 game to none.
I don't even know if this series is worth talking about, so I'm gonna just talk about it really quickly. Boston's gonna sweep Miami. It's going to be the only sweep in the first round. But it's also interesting because, the home team has won every game so far. I could see that trend continuing, and then I realized that that would mean every series had to go to 7 games. So that's not going to happen. Boston's going to win game three and game four after winning game two. But Look, I mean, there's just no Jimmy Butler. The Heat just don't have enough scoring to win this. I mean, it is what it is. Tyler Herro, Jaime Jaquez, and Bam Adebayo are not enough of a big three to beat a team that has Jason Tatum, Kristaps Porzingis, Jrue Holiday, Derek White, Jaylen Brown. Peyton Pritchard came off the bench and had good minutes. Sam Hauser came off the bench with 12 points in 14 minutes. There's just no way Miami wins this series. I just don't see it happening.
Okay, that was a short outlook on that series and recap of the game. You caught me a little off guard. You've also given a little foreshadowing, kind of spoiler alert, what happened in the other series. So let's have you talk more in detail, but we'll go to that 2-7 matchup. The Knicks playing the 76ers at home. They've played two games. I think that means they're up 2-0 based on what you just.
Well, the Knicks won game one, 111 to 104. This game, obviously, Joel Embiid doing his thing in the first half and then threw a self alley-oop and then crumpled to the floor, got injured, changed the momentum. Knicks stole it back, ended up with the lead at the half, I believe. After the Sixers had only 12 points in the second quarter, because, like I said, they just lost all their momentum. But Tyrese Maxey, he's been really good in the series so far, 33 points. In the first game, 14 of 26 shooting. Joel Embiid had 29, 8 and 6. Tobias Harris had 7 points, 9 rebounds. Not terrible. Kyle Lowry has been a pleasant surprise both in the play-in and in this series so far. 18 points on 4 of 7 from three for him. And then on the New York side of things, it's your typical game. Hartenstein had 6. Ananobi could definitely become more of a scoring threat as the series goes on. Only had 11 points in this game, but the Knicks rely on him more for his defense anyway, and they kind of want him to probably expend most of his effort on that side of the ball. But then Jalen Brunson had 22 points. It was kind of inefficient, though. 8 of 26 is not great, but 7 assists as well. And then Josh Hart was kind of the big story here. Josh Hart and Miles McBride were the two big stories for the Knicks. 22 points for Hart on 4 of 8 from 3, 5 of 12 from the field overall. And he'd been struggling with his 3-point shot, so the Sixers were leaving him alone, and he was just taking threes and he was making them. And then Miles McBride, 5 of 7 from 3, 21 points as well in the first game. So the Knicks won that one. And then last night, probably the best game of the postseason so far, easily the best night. Those two between the Knicks game and the Lakers Nuggets game, both of them won pretty much at the buzzer. The Knicks game technically wasn't a buzzer beater, but what, 10 seconds left when the Knicks won that game, pretty much. It was just an insane game. The Sixers were up 101 to 96 with 45 seconds left. Jalen Brunson made a three from the corner to cut it to two. And then Tyrese Maxey lost the ball on the inbound after that. And Dante DiVincenzo missed a three with 15 seconds that was wide open. But Hartenstein got the offensive rebound, kicked it back to DiVincenzo, and then he did hit the three the second time around. The Knicks took the lead, and then Tyrese Maxey missed a shot with 7 seconds left. OG Anunoby hit some free throws, and that iced the game after Joel Embiid missed a three. But that was a really, really great game last night. I mean, Tyrese Maxey, he was a little bit under the weather, they said, had 35 points, 10 assists, 9 rebounds, almost a triple-double for him on 12 of 22 shooting. He was especially on fire at the beginning of this game. And then Joel Embiid had 34, 10, and 6. But again, no production from anywhere else on this team. Only Tobias Harris in double figures at 10 points. Everybody else, single digits. Meanwhile, the Knicks, Brunson's still struggling to shoot from the field. 8 of 29 in this game. Still got to 24 points. But Josh Hart, once again, had a big impact on this one. Played all 48 minutes, which is the most Tom Thibodeau thing ever. He had 21 points and 15 rebounds on 4 of 7 shooting. And this time, Dante DiVincenzo was the other shooter to pitch in with 19 points on 4 of 8 shooting. So the Knicks, they're going to get better, honestly, offensively as the series goes on. It's just about if Philly can also get some production. Philly is going to get more production from the other players in the rest of the series. New York is going to get more production from Jalen Brunson as the series goes on. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of shakes out in terms of turning the tides in the series. But I still think this is going to be a close series throughout, but the Knicks are still going to win it.
DiVincenzo with a big defensive play at the end of game two there also. All right, let's move over to the 3-6 matchup. Milwaukee leads the 6-seeded Indianapolis Pacers 1 game to nothing.
Yeah, this one was crazy because there was no Giannis for the Bucks. The Pacers had destroyed the Bucks in the regular season series and in the in-season tournament. But then again, it's the playoffs. That means it's Dame time. Damian Lillard, 35 points in this game, all of those points in the first half, which, at some point I was wondering, is he just deferring for the rest of the game? And honestly, I think that's what he was doing. And I don't think that was a bad strategy because the Bucks are going to need more than just Dame and Giannis to win a title. I mean, we know that because in 2021, they had Giannis, they had Chris Middleton playing really well. They had Bobby Portis playing well. They had Brook Lopez playing well. They needed all those guys. They had Jrue Holiday obviously playing well, even though he's obviously not on this team anymore. But they need all of those guys if they're going to win a title. So I liked that Damian Lillard had 35 points in the first half, but they were beating the Pacers by so much that he just said, look, I don't need to be in takeover mode anymore. I'm going to let other guys do their thing and get into the flow of the series. And I think it's going to pay off long term because Chris Middleton had 23 points on 9 of 14 shooting. Bobby Portis had 15 points on 7 of 15 shooting. The other guys did get involved, and that is the important thing. Malik Beasley, excuse me, had 9 points off the bench. So you're looking at the Bucks getting some pretty decent offensive production really from everywhere. And then on the other side of things, Tyrese Haliburton needs to put his impact on the game. I mean, he's the leader of this team. He had 9 points, eight assists, seven rebounds, but that's not what I'm worried about. He had 9 points because he only took seven shots. You have to take more shots in the playoffs. If you are a star, it is your job to step up your game and to take the onus on yourself and take the onus and put it on yourself. That's what Pascal Siakam did. He had 36 points on 15 of 25 shooting. I'm not saying you have to keep chucking up shots when you're missing, but you do have to take a lot of shots in the postseason because it is going to fall upon your stars anyway. And Haliburton is one of those guys. He just needs to prove it. And he needs to go out in the rest of the series and be a lot more aggressive on the offensive end. Myles Turner should not be shooting 10 more shots than Haliburton did. And that's exactly what happened in the first game. That just shouldn't happen again. We'll see what happens in the second round. Even TJ McConnell took 13 shots in this game and Haliburton only took seven. So he needs to be a little bit more selfish. I know he's a kind of a pass first guy and has always been that way, but he needs to be more assertive in the series for sure.
All right, let's wrap up our look at the NBA playoffs and the Eastern Conference with the 4-5 matchup, 4-seeded Cleveland Cavaliers leading the Orlando Magic 2 games to none.
Well, this series is just kind of a defensive masterclass by the Cavs. Nobody on the Magic has gotten going, really. Franz Wagner was the second leading scorer in the first game at 18 points on 7 of 15 shooting. Paolo Banchero had a decent game, 24, 7 and 5, a good playoff debut. But he was 4 of 8 from the free throw line, 9 of 17 overall isn't too great. Jalen Suggs was 4 of 16 from the floor. Gary Harris was 0 of 6. So the Magic just had a terrible game in game one. They lost 97 to 83, like I said, 21.6% from three, 32.6% from the field. Just not going to get it done. Meanwhile, the Cavs had a lot of strong performances from their four best players. Outside of that, they really got nothing. But between Donovan Mitchell having 30 points on 11 of 21, Darius Garland having 14 points and 8 assists on 6 of 11 shooting, and then Evan Mobley and Jared Allen, both with 16-point double-doubles. Jared Allen with 18 rebounds, Evan Mobley with 11 rebounds. 6 of 12 shooting for Mobley, 6 of 10 for Jared Allen. If you're going to get that production and the Magic aren't going to score, you're going to win every single game in the series. And, I think it's really that simple. They didn't even shoot well from three in this game. Got no threes from the bench. 8 of 30 in total, which is only 26.7%. Barely any better than the Magic. Made the same amount of threes as the Magic, just took seven fewer attempts. And then in game two, Donovan Mitchell, he was leading this game early. So was Franz Wagner for the Magic. This one definitely looked closer throughout the game, but then Orlando unraveled in the middle of the second quarter, and just kind of never recovered from that. Or sorry, not in the middle of the second quarter, at the end of the first quarter. They let the Cavs take a bigger lead. They played them even throughout the rest of the game, pretty much. The Cavs had a 12-point lead at the end of the first quarter. Magic only lost the second quarter, if you want to go that way, by 2 points, lost the third by one, and actually scored more in the fourth quarter than the Cavs did. But it was just at the end of the first quarter, they just let it go once again. Some bad body language from a lot of players on the Magic, especially Franz Wagner, towards the end of that game as they couldn't really take the lid off the basket in the third and the fourth quarter. This is going to be a defensive grinded out series. They need to be ready for that. And they just weren't. Once again, Franz was 5 of 17 from the floor. Paolo Banchero, 9 of 20, 21 points. Franz Wagner, 18 points. Gary Harris this time shot better, played a better game overall, 14 points on 5 of 10 shooting, 4 of 7 from 3. But it just, again, it's just not enough. Jalen Suggs only had 9 points. He got injured in the middle of the game. Jonathan Isaac was 1 for 7, took 7 threes, missed 6 of them. And as a team, they shot 25.7% from 3. It's just not a winning formula. Even when Donovan Mitchell had an off game, shot 2 of 10 from 3, he was doing well in the first half, but then kind of fell off as the game went on efficiency-wise. Evan Mobley had 17 points. Jared Allen had 16 points, 20 rebounds. Darius Garland had 15 points. A lot of important shots for him in the third and the fourth quarter, especially. And the Cavs really haven't hit their stride offensively at all in this series, but they're still controlling it because the Magic have been just abysmal offensively. So that's got to change going forward if the Magic are going to win this series. I think they can still make it close. I just don't think they're winning the series. You can tell that they're the inexperienced team in the matchup.
All right, that wraps up our look at the start of NBA playoff action. We will now turn to Major League Baseball action with a review of the last week in MLB, starting in the American League, as always, in the Eastern Division.
This will be a quicker review than normal because we took a lot of time for the NBA. But the Baltimore Orioles lead this division at 15-7. It's the first time we've said a name other than the Yankees at the top of this division this season. Baltimore 7-3 in their last 10. The Yankees kind of slumping a little bit, down to 5-5 in their last 10. They're still playing well overall, though. They're only half a game back. They're 15-8 on the season. And once again, the AL East has everybody at or above 500. Toronto and Boston also at 13-10, both of them. And then Tampa Bay at 12-12 is last in the division. Boston picking it up recently, getting 3 games over the weekend in their series. Meanwhile, the Blue J that's against the Pirates, and then the Blue Jays took that series against the Padres. Like I said, they've been playing better since a very poor start to the season. And I'll give a special shout out to Justin Turner, who is the oldest batter in the league now, but still hitting 300, still mashing for Toronto as he continues his league tour post in his post Dodgers career. And then in the Central, the Guardians 16-6 are leading it. They have the best record in baseball, which is still crazy to say, but you know, it might end soon. We'll see. But for now, they are leading this division. They do have the best record in baseball. Four wins in a row, 7-3 in their last 10, just playing really good baseball on both sides. Great pitching. As you would expect from that team, the best or the least run, the fewest runs allowed in the American League, which I mean, you know, ERA is better to go by. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but they do have the least runs allowed in the entire league, and they've played pretty much the same amount of games as everybody. It's either 22 or 23 games. It doesn't make that big of a difference. So they have great pitching staff. They've also scored a lot of runs. They're second in runs scored, only to Baltimore. So a really, really good team. So far, they do have the best run differential in all of MLB. So that should tell you something. And then you have the Royals and the Tigers at 13-10. The Royals losing 3 in a row, losing their Monday game, and also losing the last 2 games of the series against the Orioles. Like I said, the Tigers have won 2 in a row, but you know they're playing decent. I mean, you gotta like what you see from the Tigers, especially from their pitching staff so far. Some more offensive production would be nice. That would help them actually be able to sustain this over the course of the whole season. But for now, they're getting enough to win some games. And then you have the Twins, who have just been awful all year offensively, 8-13, 4-6 in their last 10. And finally, the talk of the league: can the White Sox be even worse than the Oakland A's from last season? 3-19 so far. 13 games back in this division. They have scored 45 runs in 22 games. That is barely more than 2 runs per game. An absolutely embarrassing team that is being put out there on a day-to-day basis when you look at that lineup. Pitchers are going to start sitting out games with soreness the game before they play Chicago because they're going to say, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. I don't want to play Cleveland. I'm injured. Give me an extra day. I'll pitch against the White Sox instead. They're going to do that. That's going to boost someone's Cy Young odds. I'm looking at Cole Reagans. I'm looking at Tarek Skubal in this division. Pablo Lopez in this division. The White Sox are just awful offensively. It is what it is. Not worth talking about it anymore. And then you have the AL West, which has really been a struggle. Both Western divisions actually have been a struggle, despite the World Series favorite and the teams that went to the World Series last year all being in the West in the AL or in the NL. But the Rangers lead the AL West at 12-11. Finally, the A's aren't at the top of this division anymore. The Angels, I mean, just seeing that week after week was just stupid. But look, the Rangers 5-5 in their last 10. They're not playing amazing. They're not playing poorly either. They'll get healthier as the year goes on. Potentially, they'll probably do their same thing again where they make moves at the deadline. Their offense has been great though, good enough to keep them afloat. The Mariners at 11-11, the opposite story of the Rangers. They are 7-3 in their last 10, so they're heating up a bit. And they have been all about their pitching. I mean, they've scored 30 fewer runs than the Rangers have. They only have 84 runs on the year, which is, you know, a little bit less than 4 runs per game, but their pitching staff has only allowed 81. So this is a really good pitching staff. We know this team is anchored by their pitching. They're going to need more offense if they're going to want to make the playoffs. But for now, that's not a concern. That's a trade deadline thing in, you know, a month and a half-ish, maybe beyond that. That's when you start to worry about that. But for now, they'll need more offense in the future. It's fine for now. Then you have the A's and the Angels at 9-14. The Angels have finally cooled off, lost 5 in a row. The A's actually not playing terribly overall. I mean, they're still a bad team, but they're not horrible. They're not historically bad like they were last year, and they're definitely not the worst team in the league. There are at least two teams that are much, much worse than them. And then finally, somehow at the bottom of this division still, the Houston Astros, their pitching staff just hasn't gotten its stuff together. They're 7-16 on the season. I expect it to flip around, but at this point, I'm starting to wonder how big of a hole they can dig themselves out of. They need to start doing some of that work pretty soon if they want to actually be a playoff contender in a pretty crowded American League.
Yeah, thank goodness for them, for the Chicago White Sox, who saved them from being the worst team in the American League at this point in time. But I don't think anybody's going to dethrone Chicago for that title this year. All right, let's move over to the National League, also starting in the East.
The Braves are at the top. They have the second best record in the league at 15-6, 8-2 in their last 10, just doing what the Braves do. They kind of figured their stuff out. Max Fried looking better now than he did in his first few games. The Phillies, same thing. They're 8-2 in their last 10. They've won 7 in a row. They're 15-8 on the season. They're doing their thing as well. The Mets, 12-10. They took the weekend series from the Dodgers, but then they lost the first game of the series to the Giants after losing the Sunday game of the series against the Dodgers. So they were 12-8. But now all of a sudden they look up at the standings and the Braves and the Phillies are above them once again. I guess I would say I've been pleasantly surprised, though, by this team. They're 7-3 in their last 10. I think they had won 6 in a row before the Dodgers had beaten them, or 5 in a row at least. This team's playing okay. This is decent baseball that the Mets are playing. They're playing a lot better than they did last year. They're getting a lot more production out of pretty much all of their spots in the order, except for Francisco Lindor, who's just in a little bit of an early season slump that he'll probably break out of pretty soon. But you look at this team and I don't think they definitely can't compete in this division. The Braves and the Phillies are just, I mean, you saw it this week. They had like a 5 or 6 game winning streak and they didn't make a dent in the standings because the Braves and the Phillies did the exact same thing, which has been the story over the past few years for any teams trying to win this division that are not named the Braves or the Phillies, frankly, for any team not named the Braves. But you know, the Mets can be okay as the year goes on. I think they can easily steal a wild card spot in the National League. We talked about how kind of wide open that battle is. I don't know if the team who gets second place in the Central is going to. Right now it's trending that way, but I don't know if that team is necessarily going to take a wild card spot. And the NL West has been pretty bad to start the season. So there's room for the Mets to take it up and actually make the playoffs. But we'll see if that happens as the season goes on. Washington at 10-11, just kind of average. It is what it is. They did win the series against the Dodgers in the middle of the week, but I'm not so sure that was the best form the Dodgers have shown at all. It was Glasnow's only bad outing as a Dodger, which he didn't repeat against the Mets when he had 8 shutout innings on Sunday. And then, you know, I mean, how sustainable is it that they've had a rookie come up and throw who's not even in their top 20 on their prospect list and throw two gems, really? I mean, I don't know if that's sustainable or not. They could easily regress a little bit. They could easily get better if these guys just continue to perform how they have. I mean, with young teams, it's always a matter of confidence. And if this team gets rolling, maybe they don't stop for a while. But for now, I'll temper my expectations and say they're still just a little bit below average team. And then the Marlins, who have been really, really disappointing. I mean, I didn't think this team was going to be great. You knew they were going to see some regression from last year because they play way above where they should have last year based on run differential, based on team talent, all that stuff. But 6-18 is actually really disappointing from them. The only team worse in the National League is the Rockies. So that's just disappointing overall. And then you talk about the crowded NL Central. All of these teams, 6-4 in their last 10, between the Brewers, the Cubs, and the Reds. All within 2.5 games of each other. The Brewers leading the division at 14-7 after their hot start to the season. The Cubs, though, not far behind at 13-9. And then the Reds in third at 12-10. Really, these teams all have similar profiles. They have pretty good offenses. For teams that are going to be, a low-end division winner, these lineups are producing pretty well. Yelich on the IL for the Brewers, Seiya Suzuki on the IL for the Cubs. So that doesn't help either of those teams. And then the pitching staff, the Cubs pitching staff has been kind of weak, honestly, to start the year, but that's kind of what we expected. This is more of an offensive focused team, outside of Shota Imanaga, who has been great for them. And then the Reds have been somewhere in between. They're the in-between offense of these three teams, I would argue, and also the in-between pitching staff, which is why they're 12-10. And then the Brewers have, I'd say, I mean, they've surprised me with how potent their offense has been. Their pitching staff has been really, really good. That was supposed to be the anchor of the team. They have allowed the fewest runs in the National League. Only the Guardians, Royals, and the Mariners have allowed fewer runs, and the Yankees, excuse me, have allowed fewer runs in the entire MLB. But, this is a team that's supposed to have good pitching. I mean, this is kind of what their identity is. So that's not too surprising. They just need to pick it up on the keep it going, excuse me, on the offensive end, and they'll be really good and they'll win this division if they can keep this offensive production up. I'm just not so sure they can do that as the season goes on, but we'll see. Then you have the Pirates at 12-11 starting to cool off a little bit earlier than they did last year. Last year they got to 18-8 before they just fell off the face of the earth. This year they're doing it early. Then the Cardinals, who have been disappointing to start the year, just can't get anything going on offense. Fewest runs scored in this division. Only one more run scored than the Nationals, and the same amount of runs scored as the Rockies. So not a very great offense so far from St. Louis. They're 10-13 as a result. And then you have the National League West. I have no idea how the Dodgers are winning this division. They were 1-5 last week before winning on Sunday. They have no business leading this division, yet they are. Which means it's probably going to continue for a while, considering that that was the worst stretch they're going to hit. The Padres are only a game above 500 at 13-12. They're still a half game back. They're playing decent baseball. I mean, I'll give them some credit. They are playing pretty well. They did take the series from the Dodgers last weekend, or I guess the weekend before at this point. But then you have the Diamondbacks and the Giants at 11-13. I guess the Giants, that's kind of within the expectations. They're pretty much right there. They're 6-4 in their last 10. They're around average. That's where you'd expect them to be. The Diamondbacks, however, coming off the World Series appearance, they do have a plus 26 run differential, which is actually the best in this division, and third overall in the National League, but they're somehow under 500. So that's just some bad luck. They'll figure it out as the year goes on. They'll get better. But for now, really no one in the NL West standing out. And then, of course, the Rockies at the bottom at 5-18 somehow have the second fewest runs scored in the National League despite playing at Coors Field.
All right, that wraps up our look at Major League Baseball action for the week. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, April 30th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, have another look at the NBA playoffs, and have another weekly review of MLB action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his picks for next weekend's games that will be posted, as always, on Thursday, and his MLB power rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that content on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.